No one needs to hear more about it. I actually, before I begin, I was in Toronto yesterday, actually, and spoke on Wednesday to the Ontario Library Association. And it's appropriate that I sort of share what I was talking about, because here we are at SUNY ESF, and I began the discussion by talking about apples. Because in New York, I'm guessing most of you know, we have an obsession with apples. And we understand, for example, that those red things that people buy in other supermarkets are not apples. They are apple-like products, grown to be nice and non-bruisable and red and tasteless, apparently. So that's great. And talking about Honeycrisp and all these kinds of different apples. And people were, much like you are, thinking, why am I hearing about apples when we're talking about the future of libraries? And the answer was because we're talking about innovation. We talk about change and we talk about innovation. We're really talking about thinking of new ways of doing things. And there's a sort of common thread that I've found in many libraries, in many higher education institutions. When many people talk about innovation, they almost always begin with a sort of single model in mind. And it almost always involves, you know, titanium and aluminum and a location somewhere in California. And it's always about more or less young white guys who want to go into debt and not sleep and create apps. And so I thought apples would be a nice sort of discussion from apps. That true innovation comes from what is local and what is unique. You know, as the provost was saying, the wood, the structure here represents the mission. Well, our library should also represent the missions of our institution, and the change and innovation that we develop should grow from what we do best in our local setting. One of the things that we really need to look at is not how do we define the world-class library or what the library of the future is, what the set of services are, but talk about what our services are, our future. And as librarians, our job is not to make everything look alike. It is not, you know, in the sort of holdover from Melville Dewey echoing through the century to be efficient and to simply standardize everything so we can fit an industrial model, but quite the opposite, so that we can be extraordinarily local. We can be amazingly reflective of the institutions, the expertise, the students, the concerns, the locality of what happens around us. And that our role as librarians is not to create some sort of uniform Walmart-like look to the people who use our libraries, but to create amazingly local, very understandable systems. And our job as librarians is to then talk to other librarians and figure out not simply how to borrow or adopt services, but to adapt services to that local need. So what makes us academic librarians is not because we all do the same thing, but it's because we work in the same general context and we have a sense of what our overall mission is, but how we accomplish that is going to be very, very, very different. In ESF, it may involve, for example, collections of dead animals, which I think is lovely. We have dead animals on display at Syracuse University as well. They're usually tenured, but you have to do a faculty joke to get into it, right? All right, so let's move into it. Let's talk about the idea of an academic platform for the future. And really, we know that whenever we're talking about the future, we're talking about tomorrow. And that talking about 2020 and 2025 may be wonderful to capture people's imagination, but we are at the point now where we need to be constantly changing and adapting. So with that, let me first begin, as a good academic, by telling you everything why my talk does not matter. So the future of academic libraries is clearly multifaceted. It involves community creation. Is our library a community hub? Are we a place where faculty and students and staff and administration come together? Yes. It is clearly founded on learning, not simply, by the way, because we are in an academy. Let me be very clear about this. Simply because you have a budget line associated with the university does not inherently mean you are in the learning business. Food service, we can learn a lot about calories and consumptions and what you can do with, you know, liquid cheese, but that doesn't mean it's inherently pushing forward academic achievement unless we design it to do so. I mean, we've seen food service in universities where actually it is about learning about nutrition. It is about learning about healthy, taking care of yourself, understanding that taking care of yourself does lead to academic achievement, but it takes specific design, construction, and thought around it. And the same can be said for a library. Simply because you are an academic library does not make you part of the learning mission of your university. It takes a decision. It takes choices, and it takes strategy and planning to make it happen. We must realize that when we stand up before our provosts and our faculties and our parents and our students and say, you should come to SUNY fill in the blank because the library will help you achieve more, a natural and acceptable question should be, how? And can you demonstrate that? Can we truly say that if an undergraduate spends more time in our libraries, they will do better in their course of study? Can we say that if faculty have ready and easy access to online databases wherever they are in the world, that they will produce better research? Can we say that simply by checking in and checking out, by having community hubs, by having learning centers, by having facilities like this, by putting the coffee bar in, that we produce better physicists, better managers, better communicators, better forestry managers, etc.? Because if we can't, or rather if we can't prove it, then are we truly dedicated to that as our mission? Now, issues of privacy, issues of data, all of that is important, and I hope that throughout the day you talk about it. But I want to move past the idea that, oh, that's not our job. The faculty teach in the classroom, we will support and make it wonderful, but if that student gets an A, it's sort of their problem. It's our problem. We see this in accreditation. If we want to remain as higher education, when middle states or whatever knocks on our door and says, it's time to be accredited, they are no longer asking how many volumes you have. They're asking, what was the achievement of your students and how can you prove that you were a part of it? That is a very different and I think better question, but it's one that has put us in a bit of a defensive role. So, the other thing is the student experience itself. I will not be discussing the student experience itself. I was a student. You were students. We somehow believe that that somehow makes us masters of the student experience, but let's face it, that makes us masters of what happened X number of years ago and normally where graduate students create bars. Is that on a Vita? Because that would be an awesome Vita entry. Study and socialization among the graduate students. So we will have discussions of student experience. That's not where I'm going to spend a huge amount of time. Obviously very important. Special collections. The idea of being local and unique and what makes us local and unique and how we utilize special collections. I was with my adopted child, and I don't mean that in a legal way. I mean that our best friends had the baby first, so that became the practice child. And so the practice child, frighteningly enough, is now looking at colleges. And so I walked him through Syracuse, and I walked him up to our special collections, and he held an Oscar statuette in his hand, and it was like, we've sold this, we're done. He's coming here, right? Actually, he's not, because it's too close to his parents. But he was ready. He was considering it. You know, that notion that somehow special collections can be utilized not only in philosophy and history courses, but in technology courses and communication courses and forestry courses and all of these things. And what uniquely makes that collection is astounding. And I'm looking at Peter just because he can take back. I'm still an immense fan of the Special Collections Research Laboratory and the model that was built out of Syracuse that said this is not simply a place to collect and preserve, but for access and study, and we need to link this out into a global dialogue. And that's an amazing, amazing idea, which I won't talk about. Linked to the future of higher education, which is we can talk all we want about the values and wonders that we can produce, but if our universities go bankrupt and out of business or we get replaced, then really does it matter? The future of higher education is an amazing discussion, and we need to be intimately involved with it. I'll tell you, the first place we need to be intimately involved with it is the notion that students are customers, because they are not. Students are not customers. Students are students. They're people. Think about for a moment when a student graduates, the first job they get is on us, right? I got a degree from. The year, 10 years out, the next student we recruit and bring in is on them. Oh, have you seen our alumni? Have you seen what they performed? Do you look at their average salaries? Do you look at coming back and discussing, they create alumni groups. That relationship is much more intimate, intricate, and complex than simply someone who buys an education. Now, we know this because if the customer were always right, they would all get A's. And as Jeffrey Katzer, a mentor of mine, once said, I teach for free, they pay me to grade. It's a really bizarre thing. If you think about it from a customer standpoint, people give us money to tell them when they're wrong. Right? Now, hopefully to get them to write, but part of it is telling them that they're wrong and to rank them and give them achievement. That is not a customer relationship, nor should it ever be. But we know that there are discussions right now in boardrooms and in chancellor's offices and elsewhere about how we can monetize the data of our students to look at revenue streams. We know what classes they take, what books they read. We know what they eat late at night. We know their food plan. We know who they're living next to and with, and we can see when they come in out of what building. Clearly, we can turn that into the next tracking system. And if we look at them as customers and we look at ourselves as producers and providers and revenue generators, we don't understand that that is a fundamental violation of a community and society's creation of the academy. So, I will also not talk about that. What I want to talk about today, because it's all about me, is the life of a faculty member. But I want to talk about a faculty perspective for a reason. That is that I see the faculty experience as a sort of keystone experience, right? The student experience is based on what kind of faculty they have access to, and the curriculum they go through is a faculty decision. That those students may move in and out of the systems, but faculty tend to stay, sometimes way too long, throughout the life of that process and faculty governance. So why I'm going to take it from a faculty perspective, I'm hoping that you will see it enhanced throughout the day on how that links to other key stakeholders such as students, such as administrators, such as staff. So let's start with what business we are in. The business of academic libraries and the business of academy, we're dealing right now with a bit of schizophrenia, right? We are about teaching and research. And if you're sitting there and you're saying, well, of course we're about teaching and research, duh, Dave. What's interesting is we are simultaneously both about both, and both are the most important thing we do, which means it's not true, right? We can play this game all we want, but the notion here that we are being pulled in multiple directions because we are defining and supporting these endeavors in a different way. We're all about research, so we create different research profiles, and we enhance sponsored programs, and we build systems for management. We track you by how much funding you bring in, and we enhance and support people who bring in greater funding. Research, research, research. Teaching, it's all about teaching, and so we want the faculty in the classroom, and we want student experience, and we're going to bring and put our arms around students and love them dearly. And the thing is that that becomes a different support structure with a different reward system with a different set of initiatives. That's schizophrenia. We are living in a bimodal world, and frankly, manic depressant, and all the other therapy terms, let's face it, we own those. We're all working with people that clearly exhibit those on a regular basis. Okay. So what we really want to talk about is, are we in one of those or the others of those? Oh, but Dave, you know, SUNY Stony Brook, they're in the research, and SUNY Geneseo, we're more in this, and oh, we... doesn't work. It's a muddle. And when we look at the academic university, I would argue, however, that our role and the role we play in it remains pretty constant in both of those worlds, and I'm going to argue that actually that's going to help those worlds come together. That the purpose of a good academic library is to accelerate scholarly conversation. That our job is to help scholars and future scholars and scholars in training and all these folks to better understand society and improve the society that we are around. And that's a conversation. That conversation happens in scholarly press. That conversation happens in our classroom. That scholarly conversation happens outside over a turkey burger buying cool maple syrup, which is my afternoon plan. So, this is not new. This is my wording, but I just want to read a quick quote here. Perhaps it is an overstatement to say that the academic librarians are drifting in a vast sea of information and technological advances, searching for an appropriate course of action. Nevertheless, we appear to have lost the stabilizing rudder of confidence in who we are and what we are to do. Now, that's a wonderful quote, which we could say sets up a conversation on the future of libraries. What is particularly interesting about this quote by Joan Bechtel is that she wrote this in 1986. In 1986, we were having the same conversation. And we will have the same conversation ever. And quite frankly, it's all right to have that conversation, because if you don't talk about what our rudder is and where we're centered on a regular basis, you simply do the same thing over and over and over and over again. So I'm all for having continuous conversations, but let's not pretend that for somehow 2016 is a unique point in time where a crisis is brewing. This is something, I mean, Melville Dewey probably walked out of Columbia at one point going, geez, this technological stuff is killing me. All these students are writing notes to each other. And like, it's the equivalent of Twitter. It really is. But the other thing, back to our schizophrenia, and this is where I talk about it, is it is not that we know that teaching and research are not unique endeavors. So this is a report that came out of the Modern Language Association. Over 62% of departments that they surveyed report that publication increased in importance in tenure decisions over the last 10 years. The percentage of departments ranking scholarship of primary importance over teaching has more than doubled since the last comparable survey conducted by Thomas Wilcox in 1968, from 35.4% to 75.7%. So we can say we're all about the students all we want. Yet when we look at rewards, tenure, promotion, how we support it, how we count it, what matters? They have to have the PhD. It has to be in a field, a terminal degree. Was it in a journal? As I had once a colleague said, he said, it's very easy to quantify a tenure case. He said, every book counts for 2 points. Every conference proceeding counts for 1 point. And every peer-reviewed journal article counts for a million, gazillion, billion points. Right? We know that we live in this age. And we, as scholars, as librarian scholars, as people supporting this endeavor, see this on a regular basis. We're getting people coming into our libraries that never used to come into libraries asking questions they never had to ask before. And this is not an isolated finding. As suggested by the main title of the recently published article, Publish or Perish, publication expectations are high, are a significant part of the promotion and tenure process for faculty members. Once the exclusive purview of doctoral granting universities, research expectations, including publishing in academic journals, are now common for a range of other college and universities. And we can add to that seeking funding, getting grants, getting money, getting conference proceedings, making it available to the public, etc. This divide between teaching and research, if we look at it as a divide, research, and frankly, even labeling as research is a little disingenuous, publications are winning this battle. So, what does that mean to us? Well, I think what it means to us is that we need to see this as not a schizophrenic bimodal world. We need to understand that research, teaching, and service are all aspects of the same thing. We discover, we understand, we explore the universe, and we invite our students to be part of that and participate in it. We share that together. That when a faculty member goes and gives a conference, they are both doing service and teaching and building relationships that can be used for research in the future. But when we look back to our service, how are our library services set up? Are they set up in this sort of joint way, or do we have the same schizophrenia that our institutions are showing to our faculty members? When someone walks in and says, I'm going to do a research paper, do we send them over to the reference desk to look at all the literature behind it? And when they publish the paper, that comes in acquisitions over here. And oh, there's data? Data goes to our repository down the street. Oh, you want to turn into teaching? Sorry, that's a different liaison library. They're over there. Our faculty members are coming, being battered back and forth about what they're supposed to be doing, and they walk into a library that batters them back and forth even more. Do we reinforce a model that is increasingly being recognized as dysfunctional? Or do we think about how we recombine these means by rethinking a platform for these different activities? So right now, the sort of view of libraries, as we know, is morphing and shifting. It's morphing and shifting in academics, it's morphing in schools, it's morphing in public. The idea of what a library is changing. And while it has never been one thing, in retrospect, we sort of assign labels. It's kind of like, well, there was the Bronze Era, and there was the Rock Era, and there was the Microfiche Era, and there was, right? And so in retrospect, we say, well, there was an era of collections when the library was, the value was collecting. We brought it all together. I remember teaching a doctoral seminar. And during this doctoral seminar, we were talking about the future of libraries. And this was 7 years ago. And I said to, as we moved through it, I said, one of the values, one of the value propositions that libraries put forward, why do we need a library, is because not everything will be digitized. 7 years ago, a group of 10 PhD students laughed simultaneously when I said that. They said, really? That's what they thought? Now, we can still make the argument. Trust me, we're really good at making the argument. We can show them. But the understanding of the future academics, the understanding of people moving through that system, is if it's not digital, it doesn't exist. So we may not digitize everything, but does it matter? When people think that if unless it's digital, it doesn't exist. That changes. So we've moved from the collection-centric move, and then we move to services. So we're service-based. So the idea is that we provide ready service, user experience, how it happens on the web, how it looks. That's a different view. The library is service. And I would argue that we really are now moving into the idea of library as platform, and I would love to think that I'm unique in thinking this, but I have to give a couple of other people credit as well. David Weinberg wrote a beautiful piece of Libraries Platform in the Library Journal. You also see the Digital Public Library of America, which is hilarious because the Digital Public Library of America is, in essence, an effort of great big academic libraries. Right? Harvard sort of said, hey, we got a bunch of files. Let's put them online. Right? And then they got a bunch of other people, and it's become this sort of rolling idea of a library, but many people on the outside of DPLA look at it and see stuff. Oh, cool, pictures of, right? Students at college level and at grade school level and faculty doing presentations are like, cool, I can find pictures on. But if you look at really what happens in the DPLA, and why I'm a big supporter of DPLA is not their collections and not their front end, it's their convening of conversations around capabilities, metadata standards, open data systems, APIs, how do we work together? They're convening discussions around ebooks and e-journals, not simply to say what do we have, but what should they look like, how should they work, how can we put them together? The library's platform reconceives the library instead of the idea of it being a set of services or a collection as a set of functions and a set of services and data that enable community learning. That you tie into a library to get certain things out and you recombine and remix it for your purpose, your local need. And so one quick example of this is we say, well, we have a catalog. And if we've been in this room long enough, at some point we used to say we had an OPAC, which was hilarious because then people would think we were talking about OPEC and they thought we were rich with oil money. I think we should go back to that world. But this idea that, you know, you have the user, the student, the faculty member, the customer, whatever words you want to use, please don't use customer. Please don't use user. Can I just take a moment? Please don't use user. Could I have it by show of hands? I shouldn't set it up this way, but by a show of hands, how many people would say that they agree with the statement, we work hard to satisfy the needs of our users? Keep that hands up. Come on. This is the interactive portion of our day. Keep your hands up if you would like to brag about being used. Aren't you glad I didn't do this with consumer, right? This idea that, once again, we have the stuff, we produce it, we're the publisher, we're the holders, they use us, they consume us, they walk away. That relationship, us versus them, goes back to this nature of the university. Our students are not our customers. They are part of us. They are part of the academy, they are part of society, they shape us, they change us, they make it part of us. So why do we call them users when in fact they are members, they are participants, they are part of what we do? They're students, they're learners, they're scholars in making. Anything but the idea that somehow they buy rights from us. Because I don't think that's the world we come from. That's not why we got into librarians. While everyone has been terrified to discover that by becoming a librarian, you become a lawyer and licensing manager, that's not why we did it to begin with. I can't imagine one of you said, I want to be a librarian because if I can negotiate that next Elsevier contract, oh, I can go to my grave happy. That's not why we did it. We did it for learning and interaction and empowerment and becoming part of a community and making society better. So why is it that we adopt a language about consumption and division and commerce? So be very careful about that language. But anyway, the member, the student, the faculty member, whomever, comes through our catalog and they look for stuff. And we know that in the old days they looked for publishing stuff and what we held on the shelves, but we know that that's quickly expanded to looking at photographs and audio images and multimedia and licensed resources. And so really what we've done is we've put a whole discovery layer on it. And so the idea now is that the member comes to this sort of system we've put together as a platform. Right? So we have catalogs, but we have DSpace, and we have our digital repository systems, and we have our digital licensing managers and our URL rectifiers and our metadata repositories, and we have all of that. And we have learned over time. First of all, we should need to take a moment to say that we have that. Think about this. 10 years ago, if I had said institutional repository, we need that metadata management, you would have either looked up in horror, you would have said, when are we going to have the time to do it? And now we just sort of go, yeah. Right? That didn't happen by accident. The discovery of having a discovery layer, of creating a simple way to search across databases, did not happen because a vendor dreamed it up one day and said, we can sell this. It came from a constant push on our part to say, our students, our faculty, our administration are failing in their discovery of the system. It is too complex. Make it better. And yes, we started with things like Z3950 and OAI and all this other early stuff, but that led to the idea of needing these as a system that we could buy and consume and license and et cetera. But this platform has content. Right? Digital content, unique content, local collections, student-generated materials, dissertations, papers. It has bibliographic data, metadata, sure, links to external resources, links to referenced resources and things like DPLA. It has within it profiles. We now have profiles of individuals, what their borrowing privileges are, what they need, what their rank is, etc. And we're including things like events, what's happening on the campus, where things are going, oh, what happened for this. And we know that once this platform's out here, this platform that contains this data, we're not stuck to one output. We have now, whether we knew it or not, built a platform, licensed, purchased, modified, whatever you want to call it, that can have multiple outputs. That output can look at things like university calendars. You don't go to the catalog and search for a university calendar, but we can generate a university calendar outside of our platform. We know that, for example, built on these profiles, we can create faculty web presence size. What's the plural of presences? Anyway, right? Create a website, create a blog, create a material. We can be the technological support for creating an external face for faculty and departments. And we can grab this whole discovery layer so people can search it again. But the idea of a platform is we're not limited. We can remix this in a different way. For example, one of the things we can put in here is the concept of a course. So if you're anything like me, you use Blackboard. And if you're anything like me, anytime you get near one of these, it begins with Blackboard sucks. Oh, man. I have to use it. It's horrible, right? Have you ever thought, why don't we replace it? You said, yes, of course I thought that, Dave. But why don't we replace that? If you think about what a course is in essence an event offered by someone with a profile, faculty member, department, etc., that links to content, and bibliographic data and links. And that can then go into something like an academic learning management system, or in terms of our community engagement, into open courses, MOOCs, what have you. Why aren't we taking our investment in library infrastructure and telling our universities that simply acquiring Blackboard, that let's face it, the name itself indicates that we are replicating a 19th century model of education, a Blackboard, hello, right? It's not even a whiteboard. No, it's slate, right? And it has colored chalk on it, but it's what is it? It's a bunch of ways to put up a lecture and a discussion and a bunch of crap. And by the way, we'll make it easy to license this bunch of stuff. It is not an innovative way of doing constructivist learning styles. It's not an innovative way of flipping classrooms. And it's limited because we're always having to go to this large monopoly to see if we can change something. Most of our expertise and value in Blackboard is our ability to subvert Blackboard. Think about that for a moment. Your value in Blackboard is your ability to screw it over. That's an indication of a problem. By the way, yes, you can say the same thing with our discovery systems and our area. I get that. But if you think about what platform we have built around discovery of information and knowledge, it is an ideal system to build courseware. And we have the infrastructure, the investment, and the ability to do it. And it brings us back to the central of both research and teaching. That's the concept of platform. Now let's extend this for a moment and talk about the idea of the university itself as a platform. The university itself, as from a faculty perspective, once again, all my caveats stand, but you'll see that this certainly overlaps with the notion of different types of faculty, librarians, administrators, and students. And yes, this is SUNY ESF. Steve congratulated me on finding the right image to bring up. What does it do? From a faculty member standpoint, so once again, I apologize, it's just who I am, and you've dealt with faculty enough to know I'm not going to change. It provides me space. It provides me a place. It provides me a place to teach, to research. It gives me an office. It's a place to go and hang out, hopefully not spend the wrong kind of time with co-eds, and I can send space. It gives me laboratories. It gives me access to facilities. If it's a fiscal agent, it pays me. This is good. Not only does it pay me, but if I'm able to generate and create external research, it's a way that they can handle the money, so I don't have to be an accountant, so that I can get the not-for-profit status, right? This is the idea of faculty almost as independent contractor, but it's certainly currently how we think about it. It provides a brand. Once again, I'm from Syracuse University, which, by the way, in Toronto helped me get 1 gigabyte of data through Rogers Communication. Because it turns out the guy was a big Syracuse fan. So it provides me with my telecommunications infrastructure if I find a good fan. Anyway, the brand, right? I'm from Harvard. I'm from SUNY this. I'm from SUNY that. And a lot of our administration is spent thinking about how do we build up that brand? How do we enrich that brand? What is that brand? Is it student-centered, et cetera? It provides me with access to peers, a place, a colleague, a faculty where like-minded people can come. And it provides me with access to a knowledge infrastructure of which the library used to be the monopoly of that system. Right? Libraries no longer hold a monopoly in the knowledge infrastructure. That doesn't mean libraries are unimportant or smaller or less or going obsolete. We simply realize that that knowledge infrastructure is now greater than it's ever been. And it didn't happen by the library's span and scope getting bigger. It happened by adding additional resources. Lynda.com for online education resources. Academia.edu, don't get me started, on creating social networks for access and visibility. Google Scholar is now the go-to resource. We can talk about Scopus and Web of Science all we want, but we have to realize that Google Scholar is the resource that most universities go to. Why? Because they're a platform. Not only do they provide the access and do a better job than Scopus and such in finding it. Yes, it's dirtier data. Dave, it's dirtier data. It's more citations for a faculty. Make it as damn dirty as you want. I want it sloppy and muddy if it adds numbers. Right? That's the mentality. But it's a platform because not only can I get Google Scholar and search it, I can plug it into things like the Publish or Perish piece of software that's put out there that will do citation and impact analysis, and it will give me H indexes and G indexes, which even if I don't know what they are, I'm pretty sure they sound impressive, so I'm going to include them in my tenure package. Can Scopus and Web of Science do that? Yes, Dave, absolutely. Can it do it as seamlessly and easily as a click? Well, we're trying. So Google Scholar is either part of your knowledge infrastructure, of which you are aware and part of making it, or it is a competitor to your knowledge infrastructure, in which case you will lose. So what else can we do with this platform? Now, advantages of thinking platform, the advantages of reconceptualizing the library as a platform and not simply a place or a collection or a series of disconnected services. First, you focus on integration and interoperability. The idea is that platforms are all about making things work together, right? It's the discovery layer all over again. I can search our physical collection, our digital collection, our licensed resources, our materials. That's the advantage of a platform. It's what we tried to do when we contracted these enormous contracts to SAP and outside vending companies so that we could create My Slices and My SUNY and My, that bring my tax information with my parking information, that bring it to my healthcare information, etc. That's the notion of platform. We focus on lightweight services that can be combined. Rather than thinking of building the big siloed system, we think of building lots of little pieces that can be combined in unique ways, and they tend towards openness, allowing unanticipated connections and combinations. Let me make that a little bit more real by giving you three examples of what platform thinking can bring to some pretty traditional ideas. Holds. Faculty holds, right? So we have course readings. Faculty comes in and they say, yes, University of Georgia was sued out, so I know I need to now put it behind a password. These are the readings that I need you to hold for my class. Okay. That's the second floor. Oh, you got to talk to that person. Oh, that's the system we built for it. If we think of it instead as a platform, what we end up getting is a bunch of faculty-authored intellectual property submitted to us. And you go, well, what do you mean, Dave? They're not giving us their articles. They might. Well, they're giving you their syllabi. And think about what a syllabus is for a moment. A syllabus is much less about what the assignments are and much more about an intellectual map of a discussion. What a faculty member, an adjunct, an instructor, what you put together with a syllabus is something that says, this is a topic, and this is what I see is related to this topic, this reading, this book, this material, this article, this activity, this input, this course. We get that map, and suddenly what we can begin doing is that can reach into the class itself. So suddenly, our whole system becomes in Blackboard. To integrate yourself into Blackboard is not to have a library link in Blackboard. That is not integration, that is capitulation. That is to say, the best we can do is, well, if you need a library, click here. Imagine if it was, no, we're directly integrated, so we know those resources that are provided. We can provide, yes, the copyright and intellectual side, but we can then say things like, by the way, did you know that these readings are also used in a completely different discipline? I had a faculty member, Scott Nicholson, and he wrote a wonderful piece on sort of librarianship, and he linked to a bunch of papers about anthropology. And we've seen in some libraries the hiring of anthropologists to come in and study the culture of our universities. So what he found was a link between library science and anthropology. And by the way, they're also used in archaeology, and they're also used here, and they're used in governance and whatever. And suddenly we have the ability to say, did you know that your class is a lot like your class and you never knew you existed? Let's get you together. We can provide analytics that begin looking at how universities are tied together rather than hand-waving about interdisciplinarity. We can see it in an authentic way. Look at data repositories, right? I got a data set. What do I do with it? Well, put it here. Well, why do we put it there? One, we can do the sort of traditional beg, it's for community good. You have data. You really should share it. You really should. Stand on the shoulders of giants, please. Works beautifully, right? At the same time, we can foster scholarly collaboration. If you put it in, other scholars can use your data and look at it. And the same thing, we can do regulatory compliance. Do you want to see the difference between begging people to give you data and having someone knock on the door and going, if you would like your check this week, you must deposit the data to be in agreement with NIH, NSF, whatever data? Different conversation totally. It changes the role of the academic library from beggars and choosers to essential and integral. Faculty profiles. You come and you create a faculty profile. Yes, we get up-to-date records of scholarly output, but you get in return a university face, part of university communications, authentic data for tenure. It boggles my mind that most provosts, and I will include mine who I know well, can more easily find out my healthcare status than my latest journal article. It boggles my mind that whether you're in teaching or scholarship as your primary in an academic environment, it is easier to get a hold of and understand my financial situation than it is my scholarly situation. Because we don't look at data collection. The cobbler's children have no shoes. Now, one last thing I will leave you with, because clearly I'm just up here to preach at you and you already know this stuff, but this is the next stage of platform. The next stage of platform, everyone's sort of like, yeah, we're a platform. Yeah, we get it, it's a platform. But there's an interesting discussion going on now about the difference between a platform and a publisher. All right? So Random House is a publisher. What that means is that they do all of these services for authors to get information out. CreateSpace is a service from Amazon that allows you to self-publish physical books and Kindles and etc. What's amazing when you look at this publisher versus platform is they share an amazing amount together. For example, what we've seen in the academic and all over in the publishing world, popular, academic, what have you, is a disaggregation of services. It used to be that you looked for a publisher. Now what happens is when you look at a publisher, you're really looking at a series of coupled services. They provide editorial support. They provide, is this good, feedback, copy editing, content editing. They provide dissemination and marketing. Pick your publisher by how well they're going to be at conferences and get people to buy your books. And production. But this has been blown apart. My book, The Atlas of New Librarianship, lovely, 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 printed in Singapore. MIT Press was the publisher. That book was printed in Singapore. Why? It's cheaper, right? So that press, MIT Press, has no press left. They've broken that out. Random House doesn't have a big printer in the ground where they're sitting doing this. Same thing when I put my latest book in, MIT Press, here is my manuscript. What did they do? They sent it out for copy editing. It wasn't someone sitting in Cambridge, sitting there doing the copy editing. They had a freelancer. Likewise, indexing. Likewise, right? We see the graphic design, the all this other stuff. They've blown their service apart so they can outsource, so they can market, etc. And what that's allowed are systems to walk in and say, well, you know, we don't need the press anymore. CreateSpace will provide me with the printing. They will provide me for a fee with the editing. They will provide me for a fee with design and covers and marketing. And they have access to Amazon, which MIT Press would love to have access to. And so they can now come to us and say, we are your printing, we are your dissemination platform. So what's the big difference between a publisher and a platform? Selectivity or curation. Because if we are the platform, that means we're a bunch of disaggregated services that faculty can pick and choose from. Oh, I can use your data repository here. I can use your LMS here. I can use your holds here, right? It's how we think about it. We think about selling them service after service. And what we've really seen is that the academic library, the libraries that you run, you have been disaggregated. You have broken apart the library into lots of little pieces. We've always done it. But acquisitions and collections and metadata creation, it's a different thing. The days of we do metadata, we do cataloging for our stuff are over. We've now seen that the use of generating good metadata is now useful not only for the things we purchase, but for our faculty, but for our administration, but for our researchers and our scholars. So we see that as a service they can pick and choose from. So what the question is that many platforms are now trying to decide, are they really publishers? And publishers are trying to decide, are they really platforms? I'll give you a quick example. Service called Medium. Anyone ever use Medium? Medium.com? No? It's fun. It's great. Medium.com is a place to do short essays. And so if you want to read David Weinberger's stuff, he puts it up in Medium. And it's great because not only can you put them up like a blog, but people can go in and they can annotate it. They can do word and word, line by line, threaded discussions and annotate Medium. And so it's a really cool piece of technology. But when they started, Medium was highly selective, meaning only David Weinberger or Dave Lankus or people with a nice name could publish, not anyone. And what happened? They said, that's not enough. We have these tools and people want to use these tools and they really don't care. They're being picky. They don't want us to be picky. So they've moved to the idea of platform. They've gotten rid of the selection. YouTube. YouTube used to have nice little criteria for what goes into YouTube. YouTube is now a platform. Anyone, anywhere, go for it. Right? We're seeing this over and over again. We're even seeing this in music services, where it used to be that you would go to a record label to get your music out, or it had to be from a record label to get in Spotify or Apple. Now there are all sorts of services. So if you have a guitar and a microphone in your basement, you can publish to Apple and sell on iTunes. Right? They've moved from publisher, selective, aggregated services, high quality, etc., to platform. I'm going to argue that as a library, we need to move the other way, which is from platform, to more think about publishing. Think about this for a moment in terms of institutional repositories. Here's SUNY's digital repository. Lovely, lovely. I think I went to Binghamton. I did. Lovely. Thank you. Right? And it's great. And when you look at it, what you can do is you can check, you can look by author, you can look by subject, you can see what's new. It is a really great, let's be honest, morgue for academic publications. Right? Oh, the publishers let me have it. It's had its life. Let's go put it in cold storage downstairs and see. Maybe every so often we'll get a pulse and a hit. Why? Why? Because, you know, once again, if I were here in 2003, I don't know why I pick odd numbers, but I did, 2003, I would say institutional repositories, that's what's going to save academic libraries. Get your institutional repositories going. And we did. And no one came. And we're like, why? We worked really hard. Compare this to Public Library of Science. Now you're saying, but Dave, that's a journal. Yes, but think about what it is for a moment. It is a place where faculty, academics, students, scholars of any sorts put their articles and materials. And by the way, anyone could put their articles or materials in Public Library of Science. It has an additional layer where they take it and add peer review, editorial selection, and curation to create what we think of as Public Library of Science, which is in the journal model. But it is a layer on top of a repository. Think about for a moment that rather than me sitting out here going, oh, I think that faculty member was at Binghamton, I'll go to Binghamton, what was their name? Oh, I found it. What in the old days we would call known item searching, which we got down cold. Think of it instead as SUNY produces an amazing amount of intellectual material of great diversity. Wouldn't it be interesting to be able to highlight the impact of SUNY in physics, in biology, in forestry, in whatever it is, through the library? We have the infrastructure as a repository. Now we can begin to add a layer of curation. Another example you see is archive for the physics community. Once again, a new paper, even before peer review, this goes up. This is where physics research occurs. When it gets into a curated, published area, that is an archival strategy. When Nature publishes a physics paper, it is an archival resource because it has already been peer-reviewed, vetted, discussed, thought about, tried before it ever gets near that process 6 months down the road. Right? So instead of thinking as platform versus publisher, start thinking of platform and publisher, where that platform is our discovery layer, our digital repositories, our content management systems, our local collections, our local records, whatever it is. And yes, people can get to it directly, but if we added a layer to get out to specific communities, suddenly we have a totally different relationship with our audiences. So researchers, we might show the view that says, here's the best research, it's come through peer review, it's come through systems you know. Teachers, here's some courses and academic courseware, here's some papers that seem to match what you need, and you don't care necessarily about peer review or not. And the public can begin to browse about, right? So we all, I'm guessing, every SUNY in here has your glossy magazine, right? The one that you send your alumni to show how cool you are. How much of the data of stories and articles and background and pictures and images that are in that are in your repository? Imagine if that glossy piece that the provost had to sign off and all your alumni see are in essence a product of the library. You go, no, no, Dave, communications won't give it up. They don't need to. For the communications, you're the platform. You're allowing them to be the publisher. Now you look at this and you go, oh, Dave, we figured this out. We already did this. Congratulations, the future's done. Except this graph misses a vital and important future activity, which is that these communities are not, yes, here it is, the broken record again, consumers. They are not simply people that will read the journal and walk away. They are producers. They produce scholarly pieces. They produce courses. They produce lectures. They produce student journals. They produce student writing and literature and experimentation. They produce dead animals that are stuffed in windows. We need to include a loop that goes back to that platform. Now the institutional repository makes sense because, yes, it's not going to be the repository that gets its utilization. It's all these other publishers that shoot out. It's people who care about things like creating, blogs and podcasts, right? Blogging and alt metrics become essential and important. If you have a brilliant scholar in everything from chemistry and dilution to wonderful teachers of biology, and they want to share their work, they can use the library as their system to archive it, to catalog it, to create it, and then they can have their own blog with their layer, their curation, their view. They become a promoter of the services. Courses and MOOCs. I don't think MOOCs are going to replace universities. I think they proved that themselves. But they are fabulous and amazing marketing systems, awareness systems, getting things out. You can simply and easily produce them. And the role of the library, let me be very clear, in MOOCs and external facing is not copyright clearance. If you look at the potential of MOOCs to your library as a chance to be the copyright cop, you have missed the boat. What is it? You're the producers. You're the one that says, we get a lot of questions on this topic on biology. I know there's a biology professor. Let me work with them to produce a biology MOOC. In Auckland, the Auckland University created an amazing system on academic integrity that tens of thousands of students throughout the world utilize their resources on academic integrity to learn about copyright, copies, etc., and it's taught by a faculty member who that's their area. The university brought in video producers. They're the producers. They're the one that made it happen. They're the ones who know it, and they provide the platform to make it happen. That university loves the credit that they get for these things, and the library's at the center of making it happen, not because they're copyright cops, but because they know what people need to know, and they know the resources to bring it together. The idea of even traditional outlets. Instead of looking at the journal article 3 years after they're written, hoping that the professor didn't get a new laptop, because let's face it, the minute they get a new laptop, all the papers disappear. Or it's there, but it's in Scripcit format, right? Look at it as a production system. Imagine if you offered a copy editing service to your faculty, where they could come in, they could provide materials. Now you're going, I'm a librarian, I'm not a copy editor. Please, every freshman ask me to be a copy editor. I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. No, but there are copy editors in your alumni pool. There are copy editors over in the English and Literature department. You're bringing them together. You provide a service. You're going to get their paper before the journal does. And you're going to then help make sure it's sent out. Work with sponsored research so the grant application goes through you for format discovery systems. You then have that data and that content and can begin discussing about data access. So how do we make it real? How do we push this future? And future means we should start this tomorrow. Many of you have the pieces already in place. Many of you have these pieces done. How do we begin to energize and make it real? Well, first of all, start thinking as platforms. Start thinking interoperability. Stop thinking of services as stovepipes. We yell at the faculty. We yell at universities for being stovepipes. Do your reference people talk to your collection people? Do your acquisitions people talk to your liaison librarians? And I don't mean in one meeting every third month. I mean, are they the same groups? One university dissolved technical services and public services, and they created a unit for teaching and a unit for research. Now, I know I just said they shouldn't be divided, but for that institution, that's what made sense for them. They came in and it began to reflect what their faculty were doing or their students were doing or their disciplines were doing, etc. You look at universities, private Catholic universities in Chicago. When the provost gets up, because there's always a new provost, and she's left, so we can talk about her. A new provost comes into a university. A new provost will instantly tell you they have the five-point plan. And there's always involves a peak or a center or a concentration or some form of emphasis. And the provost will say, this is our future. And it's usually about this clear as to what the future is. Imagine what I've seen happen in Chicago at DePaul, Scott Walter. As he walked up and the provost said, we're about innovation and community. And Scott went up and said, you're right. So this is how we're going to do it. And they worked with Chicago heritage organizations, and they created partnerships with museums and the university and local school systems with diversity and bringing people from the academic challenge of K-12 into higher ed. Because it made sense, because the university, the library, was the infrastructure around learning and pedagogy. And yes, they brought in academic disciplines in the learning institution, but it was the library that brought reality to that. And it happened because they thought of themselves as a platform to make those visions happening, and not, we must now do a strategic plan where we take this entire library and gear it towards this peak of the plan. You want a new plan? No problem. We got the Legos. We'll build that for you. We must prepare our librarians for curation. If we move from librarians as people who help consumption to librarians who help production, we will have made an amazing shift in culture, and we will have actually aligned ourselves with the culture of the academy. Whether that production is scholarly output or great teaching, whether that production comes in the form of an academic paper, a blog, a podcast, or a stuffed animal outside in display. When we move it to what an academy is supposed to do, which is the creation of society and scholars and new people to take over the democracy, when we exemplify it, we better align and fit within that culture. We need a deeper understanding of instruction. When people ask you for information, their problem is not information literacy writ. They don't understand peer review, not peer review. What they're saying is, I need to learn something. And a reference interaction is not a transaction. It is an instructional session that may last one question and one answer. It may last 30 seconds. It may last an entire doctoral degree. It may last years. It may last an instructional session, but everything we do is about instruction. We have to move from capturing scholarly output to disseminating that output. Why do they not care about our repositories? Why does a faculty member in a research university not care about your repository? Because you do not generate reads, citations, and hits compared to a marketer in a journal who spends all their day figuring out how to get eyeballs onto things. You built a repository. We built. I am to blame. We built repositories that were all about manifesting and management of a thing and not messaging and eyeballs and discussions. If I find a brilliant, beautiful article in your repository, can I begin to comment? Can I begin a threaded conversation? Can I begin a discussion? Can I have my students incorporate into Blackboard so they can continue the conversation? It's a different way of looking at it than a morgue for dead documents. We have to, when we move across, we need altmetrics. Citations don't work anymore, right? My another great mentor of mine, Chuck McClure, said it best. He says, if you want citations, if you want more citations, there are three strategies. Say it first. You were the first one, you're going to be cited as the area spirals into greatness. Say it last. You're the summation capstone on an idea, and people will simply point to that as a quick and easy way to capture an entire discussion. Or say it's stupid. To correct you, they have to cite you, right? That third one has been my saving grace. But my point of that is, what are we really looking at? What is a blog hit count? How many views? What is a Vimeo hit? How many viewers on this? Does a tweet count? All of that stuff. I was in a wonderful meeting at a university where we were talking about the future of publishing, and they said, a librarian said, I am just waiting for the faculty to figure it out so we know what to do. And I just went, I sort of pulled them aside and said, look at me.
No, have a good look. This is what I considered fashionable. When I woke up this morning, my main concern was, do I teach a class this afternoon? Have I done that syllabus yet? Do you really want me to do the long-term planning of anything?
When we think about the long-term scholarly conversation, when we talk about accelerating and enhancing the scholarly conversation through publication, through discussion, through courses, through discourse, bringing together service and teaching, when we talk about the most vital and important thing, do we want the most self-absorbed, self-interested individual who has acted as an independent contractor and will go with whatever wind gets me more citations to be in charge and caretake that long-term system? I am telling you as a faculty, no, you do not. What we need are librarians. What we need are experts and people who understand discourse, who understand metrics, who understand citations, who understand that things disappear unless you take the time to describe and capture and archive, that understand the notion of use and the idea of participation, that understand learning at a fundamental level. The reason we need librarians in academia is not because you are a gatekeeper to a collection, but because you are intimate and amazing professionals and experts in something that is so fundamental and core to academia that it quite literally started when Socrates had people sit at his feet and began teaching through conversation. That is what we do. And that is so vital that having, as the provost pointed out, a conversation about whether we should have one is ridiculous because it is so fundamental to everything we do. But not if we sit to the side and plan on simply providing documents when requested. All right. Thank you very much for that time that you gave me.